This week's Labyrinth Library podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/lablib. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Hello and again, welcome to the Labyrinth Library Podcast. I hope you're groovy. You're moving and shaking. I said last week that I need to come up with something new to kind of open the podcast with. While those are new, they aren't actually very good, so I need to think of something else. But things here are good. Things here are fine. It is a very busy week. My drama class, it has their performance this Saturday. It's part of the big school arts festival. So we're rehearsing like crazy. We're trying to get as much time as we can, going over the play and doing the dances and all that stuff. And it's tough going, but the kids are getting better. And I'm looking forward to Saturday. It should be pretty good. It's Macbeth. And if you've never seen Macbeth with a Michael Jackson dance number in the middle of it, then, well, you haven't really seen Macbeth now, have you? But why don't we get on to this week's book? I gave you a clue last week that we're talking philosophy. It's part of the popular culture and philosophy series. And, you know, it's what are the ethical ramifications if your arch nemesis has no nose? And I actually got three correct guesses, which I think may be a record. Now, Paul in Spain was the first one to get it right, followed then by Millie and Marissa in the United States, who all guessed correctly that it is Harry Potter and philosophy. One of the nice things about philosophy is you really can go anywhere to find it. You can pick apart anything. There's a great website. It's not just philosophy, but there's a great website called overthinkingit.com. And if you want to see popular culture really analyzed and scrutinized far more than it needs to be, go to that website. It's very good. But let's get to this week's book. Now, when a coworker of mine, reading the book at work as I do, when this coworker noticed the title of the book, his response was, very distinct and dismissive, you know, something along the lines of, now you have to imagine I've got my nose up in the air here. Huh, I didn't think she went in putting anything philosophical in those books. All right, maybe not a direct quote, but the meaning was there. The air of disdain really was quite palpable, and while I didn't have a chance to continue the conversation, unfortunately, I got the distinct feeling that this guy was not one of J.K. Rowling's biggest fans. But he may have had a point, you know, one which mildly threatens this whole series of popular culture and philosophy books that I do enjoy. How much of what those pop culture philosophers talk about, what they dig out of there, is actually in the text? And how much of it are they just spinning from thin air? I mean, when Rowling wrote these books, was she consciously thinking of Aristotle and Plato, or the reasons why Harry Potter's decision to embrace death was so similar to that of Socrates? Was she asking herself questions about the difference between the greater good and the common good, about whether her writing was more aligned to radical feminism or liberal feminism or to feminism at all? Did she set out to create a world where the concept of a soul made sense to determine the true nature of love or to decide what makes a great leader? Well, probably not. Like many writers who are not professional philosophers, Rowling probably just set out to write a rollicking good tale. That tale, however, is necessarily supported by some of the most important issues in Western philosophy, so whether she wanted to address them directly or not, they showed up in her book. Now, one interesting question raised by this book, and there are plenty, is the question of identity and agency. And by looking at Sirius Black as a case study, Eric Seidel, in his essay, explores what it is that makes us who we are. Is it that thing that we call a mind, or is it something else? Sirius Black is a man who sometimes looks like a dog. And when he's a dog, he sometimes acts like a man. But when he's not doing that, he's acting like a dog. So is there any reason why this should be? Why a man should be a man sometimes and a dog other times? Who or what is making these distinctions for him? I mean, it seems to be a trivial question. It could probably be chalked up to Rowling's dire need for an editor as the series went along, but for Seidel, it poses a really interesting thought experiment. Is there an essential Sirius Black, regardless of the shape that he's in, and what influence does that shape then have on him? And as long as we're talking about these matters ephemeral, what of love? Now, throughout the series, Harry is told that his mother's love is what protected him from death at the hands of Voldemort. Indeed, the love that Harry feels for his friends is actually a potent protection against the Dark Lord's evil. Now, what is it about love that makes it so powerful, and what has Voldy done to himself that makes it so dangerous to him? Catherine Jack Deevil and David Paul Deevil explore the topic of love and its mysteries by looking at three characters that are far more similar than they may appear: Voldemort, Harry, and Snape. Three lost boys, as they call them, who grew up very differently and whose lives were drastically shaped by love in one way or another. Moving on then to matters that are bigger than the human heart, Jeremy Pierce explores issues of destiny and prophecy in his chapter, entitled, of course, Destiny in the Wizarding World. I mean, we all know that prophecies exist in the world of Harry Potter, like so many other fantasy series, and the prophecies may be rare, but what does it mean for an event to be prophesied? The slightly batty Professor Trelawney has had only two accurate foretellings in her otherwise fraudulent career, the first being the one that put Voldemort on the trail of Harry, and the other about Voldemort's return. But how do we judge a prophecy for its accuracy, especially once we've heard it? Is there any way to stop it, or does the very nature of causality mean that hearing the prophecy necessarily forces it to happen? Pierce goes back to Aristotle on this one and tries to untangle all the different ways that a brief glimpse at the future could be revealed without ruining everything. Now, if you're into politics, there's something for the politics as well. Andrew Mills looks at the issue of patriotism. What is it, and how is it a good thing? How is the loyalty of a Hogwarts student to her house morally different from the loyalty of a Death Eater to their Dark Lord? Is patriotism morally acceptable in any way? And if so, how? And what about Dumbledore? His hands-off approach to dealing with the school has caused some people to hold him up as a model of libertarian governance. He doesn't meddle in others' affairs. He allows Harry and his friends all the freedom they need and generally tries to govern as little as possible. But is he really a libertarian? Beth Admiral and Regan Lance try to figure that out. And what makes Dumbledore worthy of the power and influence he has, anyway? Is this the sort of man who should be a leader? David Leigh Williams and Alan J. Kenner hark back to the great story of the Ring of Gyges and Plato's assertion that the one best suited to lead is the one who wants it least. Things even get a little bit metafictional, too, if you like that kind of thing. See, back in 2007, after the series was finished and in the hands of the fans, Rowling announced that she had always thought of Dumbledore as gay. Some fans loved the idea, and others utterly hated it. But there were some fans who refused to even grant her the right to make that declaration ex libris. As she hadn't put it in the books, the argument goes, it's not really true. So Tamara Zabel Gendler undertakes the very challenging task of trying to figure out how we can determine what is true in a work of fiction. Rowling probably didn't write this series with the intention of scoring philosophical points. But the fact that these philosophers can do it is a testament to the care and the thought she did put into her writing. She not only took from hundreds of years of fantasy literature, but she also drew on some of the most fundamental aspects of just being human, the need for love, the desire for power, the fear of death, and made them the centerpieces of her books. And, as luck would have it, those are just the kind of things that philosophers love to talk about. So if you are a fan of the books, I'm guessing you are, and you're a fan of philosophy, which you may be, give this one a read. Then go back and read the Harry Potter books again and see what else you can get from them. So let me give you a quote. This comes from Gregory Bassam in his essay entitled Love Potion Number 9 3/4. And it does ask about what is the nature of a love potion and what does that mean about free will. And he says, doing what we want to do may be necessary for freedom, but it is not sufficient. We must also have the freedom to do otherwise. It's a very, very philosophical thing, especially in a world where you have magic that can control your mind and control your actions. What does free will mean? And wow. So it is a fun book. It's got a lot of essays. I've noticed that the pop culture and philosophy series or genre in general is kind of off and on. You know, some of them are really good. This one had a lot of great stuff in it. Some of them, not so much. I was reading The Daily Show and philosophy book, and I think the first 5 essays basically compared Jon Stewart to Socrates. Now, once I could see it, but you know, after a while you get bored. You're like, okay, Jon Stewart is Socrates, I get it. But anyway, I liked this one. You can pick it up. Also, you can go to audibletrial.com/lablib, and you can sign up for a free trial membership with audible.com, and with it, you can download the audiobook version of Harry Potter and Philosophy as your free book. If you would like something else, there's thousands and thousands of other titles you can choose. You get one free download with your trial membership. If you stick with the service, they've got a lot more books for you to choose from. So audibletrial.com/lablib. Go support the podcast, make everybody happy. Next week, as I mentioned, I am sort of running out of backup reviews right now. A good chunk of them do still tend to be Terry Pratchett. I really went on a Terry Pratchett roll. I wish I'd seen that coming, but I really did. So we're going to do it next week. We're going to hit up another Pratchett book and try to clear those out before the podcast transitions at the end of April. So next week's book, it's going to be a Vimes book, I'll tell you that much. And it is about the repercussions of possibly the only battle on the disc where both sides ambushed each other. If you're a longtime Discworld fan, you may get that. If you're not, well, take a guess. So thank you all very much for listening, as always. I hope that whatever you do it well and you enjoy doing it. Why don't we all? All right. Have a good week, and I'll talk to you all next week. A text version of this review will be up on the blog, thelablib.org, along with any relevant links I can think of. If you have anything you want to say or any suggestions you'd like to make, please leave a comment and let me know. If you have a book you would like to recommend, I would be happy to hear it. If you'd like to send me an email, send it to labyrinthlibrary@gmail.com. And if you like what you hear, please give a review on iTunes, become a fan on Facebook, or follow LabLib on Twitter. This podcast is covered by a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, so feel free to share it, but please don't sell it or change it. The music is courtesy of Kevin MacLeod at www.incompetech.com. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week, and until then, keep reading.